Hi, I'm Francis Lamb. Thank you for downloading this week's podcast. If you ever want more on anything you hear today, you can always find it at splendidtable.org. You'll find recipes, videos, giveaways, and lots of info on all our guests and their work. That's splendidtable.org. And here's this week's show.
This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Happy New Year! I'm Sally Swift. I'm the managing producer of The Splendid Table. It's a big year for us. In case you haven't heard, we're starting out 2018 with our new host firmly in place, Francis Lamb. He'll be here next week, but in the meantime, this is a great chance for me to brag on him a little bit. He is one of the most ambitious, respected, and talented people working in food today, and we are thrilled to have him with us. He's an award-winning writer. He wrote a column for the New York Times Magazine. He was a regular judge on Top Chef Masters. He's an editor at Clarkson Potter, which is one of the premier publishers of cookbooks in the world, and he graduated first in his class from the Culinary Institute of America. Yeah, he's a bit of an overachiever, but more importantly, he is wonderful. He is curious and smart as a whip. He loves to eat and is exceedingly kind and generous. He has an especially well-tuned eye and ear for the untold story. In fact, he's devoted much of his writing career to telling the stories of people who don't often get their stories told, like this one you're going to hear next. A few years ago, Francis brought us the story of a modern-day street vendor in San Francisco. Her name is Azalina Yusope. She's a Malaysian mama, meaning she's a Tamil Muslim, and at birth, her future was sealed. If you're a mamak in Malaysia, you will most likely become a street vendor, because mamaks sell food, period. She would have been the fifth generation of vendors in her family, but she fought her way out. She became a pastry chef, and then something curious happened. All these miles away from her home, where she could be anything she wanted to be, she found herself back with the food of her past. Here's Francis with Azalina.
Azalina, it's so nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So I think a lot of people look at food vendors and street carts and food trucks and all that as this, well, a lot of people see it as a sort of a trendy thing, or they see it as a very transient thing. You know, people come and it's like the one job they can get, and so they work at it for a few years until they can get out of it. But you come from older stuff than that. You come from a family that has been street vendors for four generations before you in Malaysia. What was it like growing up in a family like that?
Well, I despise my childhood. I did not want to be a fifth generation of street vendor. Just growing up in Malaysia, as much as it's a taboo, we do practice caste system where it says in your birth certificates what ethnicity you are and what community you come from. So you're limited to things that you can do even though you have high potential. You know, we grew up in a harsh environment that's it's just hardships and poverty, and you know, we get make fun of. There's a lot of slur being thrown on at us, and that's something that I didn't want. And trying to get away as much as possible from it. So I left Malaysia when I was 15 to pursue something else. I wanted to be a lawyer or a doctor or a teacher. Those are the high, well-regarded jobs in Malaysia at that time. But with no money and no experience and no contacts and no network, I ended up going to Singapore and did an apprentice for pastry. After that, I left Malaysia and travel and work in six different countries before I ended up in the United States. That is when things just went spiral down. As a person, I feel like I have lost the identity of myself because I was living in a very superficial personality. I was just trying to be something else, which I was not. So the food that I grew up eating somehow came back to me and brought me back to the person that I was. And that was about 3.5 years ago. Just looking around, there was no mama style street food in San Francisco, and I decided to just dive in and see what will happen from there, because the food that I grew up eating kind of make me feel as a whole, as a person, and a better understanding who I am. And I somehow from there had embraced the culture that I so don't want to be in. And now all I wanted to do is just talk about Mamak food, Mamak people, and who we are and why I'm doing what I'm doing, and all this great four generations before me, all this fantastic thing that they have done that had impact on the food society in Malaysia. Especially my dad. He's been such a tremendous impact in the food culture in Malaysia for what he was doing. That's exactly where I'm standing right now. I mean, I'm trying to kind of do the same thing that the four generations before me have done. And I feel like I'm doing it kind of on the right tracks. It's growing one step at a time.
It's so interesting that you talked about really wanting to leave this culture, and then when you did, feeling estranged from it and feeling like, oh, it was the food that could bring it back to you and maybe help you see it in a new way. Do you see where you came from differently now?
Absolutely. I see where I came from in a very different perspective right now. I decided just to sell food and to use food that I grew up eating and the culture I grew up eating as a channel. And hopefully it will give some light to Mamak people. You know, there's some of them that successfully gotten away rebelliously like me. But like people like my brother and my cousins, they're still there. They're stuck. They can't do much about it. They either work in a factory or they sweep or they sell food on the street. But I'm lucky enough that I'm here in San Francisco and doing what I'm doing. It's a mecca of food culture here. So that's what I'm trying to take. I'm not looking at the negativity. I'm looking at the positivity that I have grown up into. You know, our culture is so amazing. Our weddings still have 10,000 people in one room and celebrating and blessing everybody. And you cook for 7 days and you have marriage for 7 days. And you just the food of and the ingredients and how loud we talk to each other. People always think we're fighting, but we're not fighting. That's just the way we talk to each other. and then coming from a spice-rooted family, everybody come to us if they need advice of how using spices, how to harvest them and so forth. So we basically the advisor for food culture in Malaysia. And that's so amazing that I did not see it when I was growing up. All I see is just the poverty that we have.
Yeah. But here in the United States, it seems like you really, really are making the most of the opportunity you have here. Can you tell me a little bit about your typical day? What's a typical day like for Azalina?
Well, I spend a lot of time in the kitchen. I get up at 2, I get to work by 3, and I start getting everything ready before my staff come at 7 o'clock. So by that time they come, I'm already cooking so many things that takes a really, really long time to make. By the time they come, I'm still there in the kitchen, and I'll do all my deliveries. I love to meet the buyers that have built partnership with us just to see how things are, and then in between, I'm dropping my children off at school and I come back again. And if we have high-profile events or catering events, I'm taking care of that. I'm still sending emails in the meantime. And usually my day, I don't leave my kitchen until 10:30, 11 o'clock. And by the time I get home, that's when I'm checking emails, doing invoices. And that's a very typical day for me.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's so important that I still feel in love with what I do. It's just been 3.5 years. I didn't grow up making Mamak street food. It's just here, the last 3.5 years, trying to figure out how to make this Malaysian food just almost the same as the way I have eaten them in Malaysia.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Azalina. It's been great to talk with you.
Nice talking to you, Francis.
That was Azalina Yusope with Francis Lam, our fearless leader. Azalina is owner of Azalina's in San Francisco. She left us with a recipe for her Malaysian open-faced nachos. Find it, splendidtable.org. Do you know that one of the all-time most popular recipes on our website for the last 6 years is for a greens soup? Yep, those kale marketers have really done their jobs. It's a recipe I stumbled upon in Eating Well magazine in an article called Soup for Life, written by legendary food writer and filmmaker Anna Thomas of vegetarian epicure fame. That recipe is at the top of the heap for good reason, as it's an idea that is made for this time of year when cold and sniffles and those extra pounds have moved in. Hi, Anna. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So I was very intrigued by an article that you wrote on green soups. Can you tell me what the story behind them are?
Well, you know, I've been making these green soups, and there are a number of them. It's a whole category of soup. And I've been making them for years and years now, but I remember when it really got started for me. And it's when I had this little house up in Idlewild in the mountains, and my son was going to school there, and we used to go up there, and cold, cold in the winter up in the mountains. And it was one of those gray, cold days, not one of those beautiful winter days, but one of those damp, awful winter days. And the holidays were over, and my jeans were tight because I'd eaten too many cookies. And, you know, I just felt, ugh, I needed to do something. And thank God I had been to the farmer's market and I had all these greens in the refrigerator. So I did the thing that every Polish cook does. I started cutting up onions. I mean, that's how you start everything, right? And I started cutting up onions and sautéing them and caramelizing them. And I started washing my greens and I thought, this is going to be a soup. And I made a soup out of, it was probably kale and chard and maybe spinach. Maybe it was the Triple Crown, my favorite, you know, combination. And it was so wonderful. I felt so much better right away. You know, I really felt great. And it was delicious. And I started making versions of that soup all the time. I ate it all winter. I thought, this is fantastic. This is my new diet plan. More green soup, less of everything else.
Is it medicinal for you at all?
You know, it feels like the greatest tasting medicine in the world. I mean, they were very simple green soups. They didn't have a lot of complication, a lot of ingredients, but they had a ton of greens.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit because it's not as simple. You have a real technique for this and you have actually come up with a basic green soup base that you can riff on. But I want you to talk through that because you have a couple things that I think are interesting. Namely, one are those caramelized onions and the second is rice. So talk us through quickly that basic soup.
Yeah. I caramelized a couple of onions. I cut them up and I really, you know, put them in with just a little bit of olive oil in a pan and took my time. This is one of those things you do while you're answering your email. You know, you don't have to be paying that much attention, but you have to let it have the right amount of time. I always tell people, when you think you're done caramelizing those onions, go another half hour.
So slow heat, a little bit of fat and slow heat.
And cover them to sweat them a little and keep the moisture in because you don't want them drying out so much that they burn before they have time to really soften up and caramelize. What you'll end up with is sort of an onion jam. And all you've done is put onions in a little olive oil with a pinch of salt. Mm-hmm. You haven't added anything. They just turn into this lovely, dark, rich, caramelly colored sort of onion marmalade.
So you get
the onions
going.
Are going. You wash up all your greens. If it's kale, you take it off the stems. If it's spinach, you just cut it up, charred. You know, your call. You can take it off the stems or not. And, you know, you use a lot of greens. I usually ask for about at least two big bunches of greens in a pot of soup. And it's fantastic. And then some water and some vegetable broth. This makes some of its own vegetable broth, so you don't have to add a ton. And those two or three tablespoons of arborio rice. It cooks in with the greens, it turns very soft, and when you puree the whole thing, you know, when you put your immersion blender in there and you puree it all, it gives the soup this silky, creamy texture. And of course, there's no cream in it, but it has this wonderful velvety texture from that I love. And then I season it. A little sea salt, a little pepper, a pinch of cayenne, and always a little bit of lemon juice. And how much just depends on, you know, how sour your lemons are. It is such a great soup. And then what I do is when I cook it, I don't use too much olive oil in the actual cooking process. But when I serve the soup, I drizzle a little bit of unheated olive oil on top. And the taste of that fresh olive oil, the olive oil that has not been heated, is entirely different. It's the juice of the olive. And it just is wonderful. It completely wakes up all the flavors in the soup.
That soup sounds simply delicious. Thank you for joining us, Anna.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
Anna Thomas is author of The Vegetarian Epicure and Love Soup. You can find that recipe for green soup at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Bridget Lancaster of America's Test Kitchen is on a quest for her own sourdough starter and butter in politics and religious ceremonies. I'm Sally Swift, and it's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Splendid Table is brought to you by All the Chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Sally Swift. Sometimes I think that people who are not food pros think that those people who are food pros have everything all figured out. Well, that is simply not the case. The work never stops. Just ask Bridget Lancaster from America's Test Kitchen.
So I'm Bridget Lancaster. I work for America's Test Kitchen. And we're here in my kitchen in Marblehead, just north of Boston. Today we're working on a little bit of sourdough. And George, my assistant, is always here to help me. Aren't you, George? So George is currently my favorite child. He is an 150-some pound Newfoundland. George is a great crumb catcher. George would love the sourdough. Bread is one of George's favorite foods, isn't it, George? Yeah. So many people are really intimidated by sourdough, but it's basically, if you've ever had a goldfish and you've kept it alive for more than a couple of months, you can make sourdough. You need flour and you need water. And that's it. There's something great about starting a recipe with so little. And in the flour, there's wild yeast already in there. And there's bacteria in there as well. And the yeast and the bacteria get to work. It's like a little Pac-Man. They're starting to feed off of the natural sugars. And they start to procreate and they multiply, creating thousands and thousands of microorganisms. This is George telling me to be quiet. George, come here. Here, buddy. You want a cookie? He loves these little cookies. It's little dog biscuits. So it's always good to use a glass container when you're starting sourdough. That way you can see what's going on underneath the surface. So the flour we're using is a mix, almost equal parts of whole wheat flour and all-purpose flour. It's a good idea to use organic flour for this because it's been processed less. So it's so easy to make. You have a cup of the flour mix and room temp water. For the water, you want to use distilled water, filtered water. You don't want to use tap water. Tap water has chlorine in it, and the chlorine has been shown to kill the yeast. Let me go get a wooden spoon. You can also use a rubber spatula for this. So I'm just mixing this together, and what you want to look for is the mixture to have no more streaks of dry flour. All right. I'm just going to put a piece of plastic wrap on it. We're going to leave it out here at room temperature. More fermentation happens at warmer temperatures. So putting this in the fridge is not a good idea at this point. Within 48 to 72 hours, it's going to start to bubble. And so that brings us to how we maintain our starter. Now we have to feed it. I would say this is the most high maintenance part of sourdough, but it's only about 2 weeks. So I've got another bowl here, and this is a starter that I made about 48 hours ago. I would let it go a little bit more, but you can see it's definitely a different texture from what we had before. The amount has pretty much doubled in size. It's puffy. There's a little bit of bubbling action on there, which is great. We know that the yeast is alive, the bacteria is feeding. I'm going to uncover it and we can give it a quick smell here. Dirty socks comes to mind. This is where a lot of people go, oh, it's gone off, it's bad, I gotta get rid of it. No, actually, that means it's alive. This is actually a great sign. This means that the yeast is feeding, the bacteria is multiplying. That's what you're smelling, all that lactic acid the bacteria is forming. It's funky, and not like in a good way funky. This is like stinky funky, and you gotta get through the stink to get to the really good part. So I'm gonna grab another clean bowl. So you take a quarter cup of your starter. It's almost like chewing gum or taffy at this point. And we can get rid of the rest of the starter that's in here. So that was a quarter cup of the starter and a quarter cup of water. And we're also adding a little bit more of our flour mix, about a half a cup. And we'll go ahead and stir this together. And that is your daily chore for about 10, maybe up to 14 days. Of course, you cover it with plastic wrap again. And during this time, it's going to go from a stinky, smelly mess to something that has a beautiful, tangy aroma. Think buttermilk, think yogurt. And that's when you know that your starter is ready to use. And once we're at the point where our starter has matured, we really just want it to stay alive. And this is where it gets really easy, because instead of feeding it once a day, we're going to only feed it once a week. And to do that, we scoop out about a quarter cup of our starter mixture. And this time we're not using our flour blend. We're just using all-purpose flour. So half a cup of that, a quarter cup more of our distilled water. Mix it. So now this is going to sit at room temp for 5 hours. Then we're going to move it into the fridge, and it can stay in there for up to a week before you have to do this again. And the best part of sourdough is after you take a little bit of that starter and you incorporate it into a bread recipe, you can really taste the adventure that you've gone through. It's soured, it's matured, it has all these different notes in the bread itself. Even the best bakery out there with the best sourdough bread, there's something about pulling that bread out of your own oven, cutting into that amazing crust and serving it without butter, without oil, without anything. You have a flavor profile that's unlike anything else. And if you have any scraps, be sure that you have a giant dog like my George, who's happy to clean up your mess after. Isn't that right? It's like having farm animals in your house.
Bridget Lancaster is host of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country television shows. You can find a recipe for their foolproof, almost no-need sourdough bread on the website splendidtable.org. You'd think that a book about butter would be filled with recipes, but that is exactly what Elaine Kosrova's book, Butter, A Rich History, is not filled with. Instead, it's brimming with ritual, history, politics, and science, and okay, truthfully, a couple of recipes. Elaine is the former editor of Culture, a magazine all about cheese. She's traveled the world researching this butter book, and our contributor, Melissa Clark, gets the report.
Elaine, hello. I'm so glad to be talking to you today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So one of the surprises for me in reading your book was to learn all about the connection between butter and religion. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that subject was really interesting for me too, and surprising. I wasn't expecting to find that ancient cultures around the world used butter as a sacred tool for their spiritual practices. This is going back to the Sumerians, 2500 BC, and the Vedic Aryans, the Druids, the Hindus, the Buddhists. All of these cultures use butter in their worship practices. Most of these rituals are gone, but the Tibetan Buddhists still do these elaborate butter carvings called tormas that are central to their spiritual practice.
What do you think gives butter that kind of aura that makes it seem religious or spiritual in a way?
Well, for most of butter's history, in fact, the process of making butter was mysterious. It was an enigma. You know, how is it that you can take milk and through a process of simply rocking or beating it, you know, this invisible fat that's in the milk suddenly blooms into beautiful pieces of butter? So, you know, until the late 1800s, butter was little understood but highly valued. And so it was deemed, much like pearls and oysters or rainbows, you know, some of these wonderful mysteries in the world. So that was really, I think, at the root of why butter became so useful in a sacred way, for what it symbolized, essentially.
Which was magic.
Magic, exactly.
So historically, women have always played a very big role in butter making. Would you talk a little bit about women's roles in butter making?
Well, first of all, you know, it's not overstating it to say that women really founded the butter industry, because It was taboo for men to have anything to do with the dairy arts for most of the history of humankind and, you know, since we've been milking animals. I found this across the world, this taboo against men milking, making butter, doing cheese making, and that survived up until the 1800s. You know, milk is about birth and lactation and fertility. You know, it's very much a sort of feminine domain. And because they had a monopoly on butter making, you know, they gained a certain status from it because butter, of course, was valuable.
And you got to see some of this firsthand. I know you traveled to India and you got to see some traditional butter making.
I did. I went specifically to see the butter that's made from water buffalo milk. That would be the traditional milk in India, and that was for centuries. That was the animal that was most suited to the climate in India. And so water buffalo butter is their traditional butter. It's now disappearing. Cow butter has become much more prevalent. But the water buffalo butter is a cultured product that I was particularly interested in seeing how they make it. And so I was able to go to this small village in the north of India in Punjab and meet with these two elderly women. And they showed me how they take the water buffalo milk and they culture it overnight and they make this super delicious, rich yogurt called dahi. And that dahi is then put into a churn. You know, a generation ago, it would have been a beautiful metal churn. This particular day that I was visiting, they just put it into a plastic bucket. But they still use their unique system of churning, which involves a pole, a center pole, that has a cross piece on the bottom that goes into the milk, and then they alternately pull on the ends of a rope. So imagine this center pole is being spun around by the women pulling on the ropes either side, you know, back and forth. And that system of churning doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So I really wanted to document that because, in fact, it is disappearing. Even in this particular remote village, the women told me that they use a blender now to make their butter. So I was glad I was able to document it and see it. I think in a generation, it probably won't exist anymore.
Now, you mentioned that it was cultured butter, and I know that I can buy cultured butter in the supermarket. I can also buy, I can buy a lot of different butters. I can buy high-fat European butter. I can buy sheep butter and goat butter in the health food store. Can you just walk us through the differences?
We'll start with the simplest first. That would be sweet cream butter. That is butter that's simply cream put into a churn until butter happens. And if it's an industrial churn, it happens in 3 seconds. But it's essentially just cream made into butter. If you have cultured butter, that means that the cream has been mixed with a lactic bacteria, sort of a cocktail of lactic bacteria, and allowed to ferment at least 12 hours, usually longer. And the point of that is to develop complexity of flavor in the cream. You know, butter has 120 different flavor compounds. And by culturing it, you can intensify some of the really good ones like diacetyl. That's the compound that gives us that quintessential butter flavor. And culturing also is synonymous with a little bit of acidity. So if you can balance like the sweet and the acid and the butteriness, that's a world-class butter. And then the European style that's, you know, in quotes, that's what the many labels say, that essentially means a high-fat butter, a higher fat, because the standard in the States is for 80% fat in a stick of butter. The European style, higher-fat butters can have 82, 84, 86% fat, which may not sound like a lot of difference, but when you're a baker, it makes a whole lot of difference.
So you would say bake with the European butter, and then if you were going to just spread some butter on bread and eat it, you would use the cultured butter for the extra flavor.
That's what I prefer. As far as baking, the higher fat butter is particularly good for pastry. If I'm making a cake, I don't actually feel like the extra butter fat makes much of a difference. The only exception would be a pound cake where I want that super rich density.
That makes sense. Now, talk to us about how butter gains its different flavors. You had written in the book that the flavor of butter comes from three different things, from the animal's diet, from the type and species of animal, and also from human artistry.
Yes, the variables that define the character of a butter. And they're essentially three very dynamic things, being the person, the plant, and the animal. The plant aspect in particular, it has a huge effect on the butter. You know, today animals can be fed grain or grass, and there's quite a variation in the butters that you get from that. Not only the flavor, but nutritionally as well. A grass-fed butter definitely has more micronutrients in it than a butter that's from cows that are fed grain.
And that changes seasonally.
Yeah, and certainly in places where there's winter. Right. But even then, they're having a lot of silage and haylage. They're having fermented grass in addition to a little bit of grain. So we do have a really good system in place for keeping cows on grass year-round. So, I tell people, butter is such a staple. And, you know, if you're going to have a little bit every day on your toast or your potato, whatever, I think it's really worth seeking out a good grass-fed butter.
Well, Elaine, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Elaine Kosrova's book is Butter, A Rich History. Melissa Clark's latest is Dinner in an Instant. Head to splendidtable.org for Elaine's butter-laced German pancake. That sounds great. Coming up, the time has come to stop confusing your Pilsners with your IPAs. I'm Sally Swift, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Sally Swift. Ann Taylor Pittman is the daughter of a Korean woman who married an American GI in 1967, a Mississippi farmer's son. They ended up raising their own family in Mississippi. And like a lot of children of newcomers to America, identities can be confusing, especially when you didn't look like anyone else in your school. Ann grew up Southern, not Korean. It wasn't until she was 43, a mother herself, and an editor at Cooking Light magazine, that she made a pilgrimage to Korea for a story she was writing about her mother's family. So, Anne, tell me, what was it like being Korean in the 70s in the South?
Being Korean in the South was a little lonely in the 70s. I wasn't quite sure who I was, what my identity was. I didn't know much about my mother's life. I didn't know what it meant to be Korean. I thought in my head that I looked like my friends, that I was not different from anyone, but I was reminded a lot that that I was different. And so, you know, the question that always came to me from kids, and, you know, and these are not people who meant any ill or anything negative. This was the question I always got was, are you Chinese? And, you know, I would say no, and it usually dropped at that. And there was no real understanding that there was Asian beyond Chinese. And, you know, I'm not trying to say that everyone in the South felt that way, but certainly everyone I came in contact, contact with, that was sort of their frame of reference.
So how much Korean culture did you have in your house when you were growing up?
We had a little, and it was usually through food. I lived in small towns in the Mississippi Delta, and at that time, my mother could not get ingredients to cook Korean food. So we would go to Memphis about once a month and go to a small Asian market there. So my knowledge of Korea or what it meant to be Korean was through these dishes like bulgogi, which I loved. I always loved. It's thinly shaved meat that's marinated in soy sauce and sugar, and so it's sweet and salty, and you cook it over really high heat, so it's charred, and it's just delicious. And she would cook these noodle dishes, and I always loved those. They're using these, I always called them glass noodles, these cellophane noodles made from mung beans. Every now and then, our relatives in Korea would send these packages and these little Korean toys, and the one thing that I remember, mainly because we have photographs of them, were these fancy formal Korean clothes. It's called hanbok, and it was this very shiny, very colorful, vibrant, satiny outfits for my brother and me. And we would get dressed up in those every now and then and say, look, we're Korean. And that was sort of all we knew of being Korean. My mother just didn't share much. And I don't think it was that she was trying to shut us out or anything. It was just, for her, there was a lot of, pain that she left behind. And she had started a new life in the United States and didn't want to dwell on the past.
You write a little bit in the article about how she would cook some dishes, but there were a couple dishes that she would only make for herself.
Right. My father admits to sort of leading the charge against kimchi. he never liked it. As kids, my brother and I didn't. We were terrified of kimchi. It was so strange. The smell was so strong. We were just kind of terrified of it. I since have come to love it. But we wouldn't eat that. And so my mother missed the flavors of home, and she would make soups with tofu and kimchi. And she would eat them by herself. And when I think back on it now, as an adult, I think how lonely that must have been for her to have this one sort of lifeline that keeps her connected to her culture, the one thing that she could do at home that we wouldn't participate in with her.
So you, in middle age, picked yourself up and made your first trip to Korea. You went from Seoul to Busan, right, which is where your mother was from?
That's right. I was kind of spurred on by a couple of things. One was this incident that happened. I make it sound so crazy. This incident at my kids' school. I was having lunch with my kids in their elementary school cafeteria, and a kid walked by the table on his way to put up his tray, and he looked over his shoulder, and I thought, oh, okay, he's about to say happy birthday to my kids or something because they're at the birthday table. I have twin boys, and I was there for their birthday. But he didn't say happy birthday. What he said was, hey, Chinese lady. And I was floored. And it was a really strange, I mean, it was like a scene in a movie. I felt like the camera just focused in on me and everything else blurred away, and that I was 7 years old again. And I was in a school cafeteria in Mississippi. It immediately took me back to that feeling. I came back to work and I was talking about the power that that child had to put me in this place where I felt lonely and misunderstood and where I didn't understand myself. And, you know, I thought, wow, I need to really learn a little bit more about my identity, about who I am, about what it means to be half Korean. And the only way to do that is to go to Korea.
So tell me about the food scene in Korea.
Oh, my gosh. It's so fun. It's... The food scene in Korea is very social. So a lot of restaurants are not set up to serve one or two people because it's a communal way of eating. A lot of the food is prepared on the table, at the table. So you order soup and they bring out this large communal bowl and the soup boils on the table, or there are grills for the bulgogi and you cook the food right there on the table. If you're not cooking the food on the table, you're at least all digging out of the same dishes. Sometimes you don't even have your own personal plate. You're just kind of chopsticking little bites off the same plates. It's very social. It's also incredibly intimate when you think about sharing a meal in that way. It's kind of powerful. I think it's a powerful way to connect to people. But it's also incredibly fun, very lively, lots of conversation and lots of drinking too.
So you started in Seoul, you wound up in Busan, which is your mother's town. Tell me about what that was like for you when you got there.
Busan was so different from Seoul. Seoul, I compared to Manhattan. It felt very modern, and Busan was a little gritty, less polished city. But the thing that that stood out as such a difference was that in Seoul, no one thought I was Korean. I look very Korean. My father is American, Caucasian, blonde hair, blue eyes. My mother is from Busan, South Korea. I look Korean. I don't look like my father at all. And I thought that in Seoul, people might think I was Korean, but no one did. No one thought I was Korean. I thought people might try to speak to me in Korean. No one did. But in Busan, a lot of people did. And I thought that was really kind of powerful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is where my mother was from. You know, this is her area. And maybe there's a reflection of that in me. And there was just something very powerful that moved me there, mm-hmm. being there. So my brother and I needed to take a small little day trip to a little town called Hapchan, which was about an hour and a half bus ride from Busan. And this was where we were going to meet my mother's brother, so my uncle and his wife. And we go to the bus terminal there in Busan, and we're trying to figure out how to buy our bus tickets. And this tiny woman approaches me, I mean, this tiny, tiny little woman. She starts talking to me rapidly in Korean. And I just sit there and think, oh, look, another Korean's talking to me and thinks that I'm Korean. I'm kind of sort of patting myself on the back. And, I say, I'm sorry, I don't understand. I walk away from her. And two steps into to my walking away, something echoes in my head. And I say to my brother, wait, did she just call me Anne? So he's like, I don't know. We turn around and she has a smile on her face. And I'll never forget this. It's a moment just sort of frozen. And I watch her smile sort of fade and her eyes sort of go unfocused. But we turn back and we walk back to her and her face lights up. And she looks at me and she says, Anne. She looks at my brother. She says, Tim. And then she says, in the most perfect English, I am Susie's sister. And so at this point, I think, oh my gosh, you know, this is the woman we had been told going into the trip that she was a little too frail to travel. She lives on an island off the mainland. We were told we wouldn't be able to see her. But here she's come to meet us at the bus terminal. And I was floored, overwhelmed. I was so excited and just kind of started laughing, choking, and hugging her very aggressively. and she was very happy. But then I think, you know, oh my gosh, what did she think when we turned away from her? What? I mean, did she think that she had failed, that she wasn't going to connect with us? And it was a very emotional moment. It was amazing. You know, I had never felt Korean before, although I call myself half Korean, and I am half Korean, and I look Korean.
With a Southern accent.
Right. Very Southern. I'm also incredibly Southern. But I did feel finally like I was Korean.
What did your mom say about you making this trip?
I really wanted my mother to go on this trip, you know, so I decided I was going. My brother said he would meet me there. We asked our mother to go with us. I really thought it would be great. And she's so incredibly wonderful and wise. And what she said was no, she could not go on this trip because this was our discovery to make on our own. And that, yeah, that still kind of floors me.
Anne, thank you for this story.
Thank you so much.
Anne Taylor Pittman is executive editor of Cooking Light magazine. Her article was called Mississippi Chinese Lady Goes Home to Korea. She left us with an especially easy recipe for scallion pancakes with Korean dipping sauce. They are addictive. Find them. SplendidTable.org. Now, if you've been confusing your Pilsners with your IPAs and Imperial Stouts, you need to meet up with Greg Engert. Greg has developed a flavor profile system: crisp, hop, malt, roast, smoke, fruit and spice, and tart and funky. And it's used all over the country to help drinkers understand that beer is very much like wine. He's the beer director of the Neighborhood Restaurant Group in Washington, D.C., and we set him up with a self-professed beer hater, our contributor, David Leet, to see what Greg could do with David.
Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, beer. I have to be up front right here. I hate beer. I really do. I find it very bitter. So, what do you have for me?
Well, it is a challenge, I'll be honest with you. I mean, beer's calling card for at least part of its history has indeed been bitterness. Mm-hmm. You know, hops. Hops are the thing that give bitterness to beer. Also, roasted flavors you find in stouts and porters will give you an intense bittering quality. And there's no two ways around that. You know, I think you're going to have trouble with most beers. Mm-hmm. But luckily for us, we hope today, there are a few different flavor categories out there, styles of beer, that I think we might be able to sneak in under your radar.
All right. Well, that's cool. Now, you have two beers here. Mm-hmm. They fall into what categories?
So, and these are categories that I find that work for all people who are kind of trying to transition into beer. So we kind of call these transitional categories. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the one that's probably most approachable or people would understand the best is the fruit and spice category, mm-hmm. dominated by Belgian style ales. I say that because Belgian style ales are made literally all over the globe today, kind of, you know, people's takes on the Belgian ales. And so these beers tend to be on the sweeter side. They tend to be either completely bereft of bitterness or at least just a little bit of a drying quality there.
Okay.
So that's one. And that's going to be represented by a Cellar Door from Stillwater Artisanal. And then the next one I even have probably more success with, especially for the wine drinker out there. Mm-hmm. You know, what most people don't realize is that for 99.9% of beer's history, which stretches back to the beginnings of civilization, 10,000 plus years ago, it was sour. And this is a beer called Madame Rose. It's from Goose Island out of Chicago, Illinois. And I think you'll find that it tastes more like, you know, almost like a Burgundian red wine than it does like
really?
Your typical beer.
And this falls into what category?
That's the tart and funky category.
I love that, tart and funky. Okay, so why don't you open them up and I will give them a try.
Absolutely.
I can't promise anything, but I know. I'm game.
So we're going to start with the cellar door.
Okay.
This is loosely based on a style of beer called Saison. Mm-hmm. This is a farmhouse ale style. It's brewed outside of Baltimore, but the style's from Belgium. And it's brewed with some wheat, so it's nice and crisp and refreshing, not too bitter, and it has a little bit of white sage added to the beer in the end. So.
Oh, cool. So why in glasses?
We love to pour these into glasses. Do not drink beer directly from the can or bottle because flavor is 99% aroma. Mm-hmm. So you should be swirling it like you would a fine wine.
Oh,
you should get your nose right in there.
Absolutely. Okay, there's my nose. You know, there's a cider quality almost to this.
A touch of it, yeah.
Yeah. There is no bitterness for me.
It's just effervescence, really.
That's shocking. And so the second beer, let's talk about that one.
So in the tart and funky category, mm-hmm. this is Madame Rose from mm-hmm. Goose Island in Chicago. It is a sour red ale that is aged in wine barrels with cherries.
Oh, wow. That has a phenomenal nose on that. Beautiful color, too.
Doesn't it?
Oh, that's real crisp. There's a nice... that's
beautifully acidic, amazing with food.
Yeah. What would you pair with this?
I would love this with a number of things. I love lamb chops mm-hmm. in this because think about it. It's got that Burgundy and red wine quality balancing mm-hmm. against the gamey intensity of the lamb. Ribeye steaks. Rich steaks, I think, do well. This almost sauces the dish.
Excellent. So talk about some of the other categories that you have in
Absolutely.
Your profile.
Crisp is a category that we like to use for any kind of those effervescent, refreshing beers like lagers and pilsners, things like that. Kind of beers that most people associate with the term beer. Hop is a category that brings in the kind of pale ales and IPAs.
Bitterness
mm-hmm. that you don't love too much. Then we have malt-driven beers. These are beers that capitalize on the grainy qualities, you know, toasty, nutty, caramelized, toffee-ish qualities. Mm-hmm. And then we go into roast. Roast is the stout, the porter. These taste like coffee and chocolate, latte, espresso, et cetera. And then probably one of the strangest categories in the last one is smoke. And these are beers that are produced with grain that's literally cooked over open fires, mm-hmm. giving the grain and the resulting beer the flavors of the fuel. So it'll taste kind of smoky and meaty and spicy.
So are you up for a pop quiz?
Absolutely.
All right. Knowing your categories and uh-huh. knowing your profiles, I'm going to give you the name of a dish.
Okay.
You tell me what you would pair it with.
Sure.
Okay, shrimp and grits.
Shrimp and grits. Love this with something that's peppery, got a good fruit and spice quality. So we're thinking the fruity, spicy beers. Triples are fantastic with this, Belgian-style triples.
Spicy beef chili.
Spice is tough. Alcohol and bitterness will make spice intensify on the palate. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do with something spicy is use something crisp that can kind of wash away the intensity of heat, or something sweet like a malty beer that's going to also temper the flames.
Excellent. Barbecued ribs with a vinegar mustard-based sauce.
Anytime you get acidity, you want to match acidity with acidity or with sweetness. So I would go towards maybe even something like the Madame Rose, a tart and funky beer that has a sort of vinegary note to it mm-hmm. to kind of intensify that.
All right. One of my favorites, a lobster roll with mayo, not butter. Thank you.
Lobster roll with mayo, not butter. This you can go a couple ways. Now, one way you could go is to take something that's sweeter, like a fruit and spice beer or a malty beer. Or you could take a slightly roasty beer. This sounds kind of strange. A mm-hmm. slightly roasty beer, like a milk stout. It's sweet, chocolatey. It's got a little bit of a peppery quality to it. That's going to balance the salt of the lobster itself. And you get a kind of cool complement by contrast.
Excellent. Okay. This is going to be a bit of a trick question. A stout cake, which is a cake made with Irish stout.
Right. Most people think that if something's made with something, you naturally pair it with that.
Exactly.
Now, that would be the easy way out, and you can do that. What I like to do is to bring something that's kind of fruity into the stout cake. So typically, if you have a chocolatey cake Maybe we're going to bring in a sweeter, fruitier beer. Mm-hmm. There's fantastic raspberry lambics out there that have this kind of sweet, mildly sour quality that are going to almost bring in a sauce to the cake itself.
Okay, and the last one, pasta with butter and Parmesan cheese.
Just very simple.
Very, easy. Which I make all the time, so help me.
It's fantastic. One of the best crisp beers out there is something called Kolsch. It typically comes from Cologne. And this is a crisp beer that's got a little bit of a delicate fruity note, some sweetness, bold effervescence, and almost no bitterness again. So you don't have to worry about the bitterness overwhelming the delicate flavors of the pasta.
Excellent. And then I'm curious, you put together a 500-bottle beer list, more than 500 bottles. How does one do that?
Basically, I really did use the flavor profiles to do it. You know, I wanted to make sure that we always have a nice sampling of each flavor profile represented on the list. I mean, if we had too many hoppy beers and roasty beers and you came into my restaurant, you wouldn't have anything to drink. So instead, we make sure that we always have something from every category, and that makes sure we have something for every palate, but also something for every plate. Beer and food pairing is huge. And so once we know that we have something coming from each and every category, we have something for each dish coming out of the kitchen.
That's fascinating. It was a pleasure having you, Greg.
Thank you very much.
Greg Engert is the beer director for the Neighborhood Restaurant Group, which includes Church Key and Blue Jacket in Washington, D.C. You can find Greg's beer profile guide at splendidtable.org. David Leet is the mind behind Leet's Culinaria, and his latest book is Notes on a Banana, a memoir of food, love, and manic depression. Well, that's the show for this week. Great to have you with us. Francis Lam will be here next week with a show that is Viva Mexico. Can't wait. Have a great week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, if you like what you heard here today, subscribe to our podcast and register for our free weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Francis Lam is in the house next week. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Sally Swift, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.